Today is Wednesday, February 23rd. At the United Nations, Ukraine appealed for the body to stop Russia's aggressive plans.
We are currently at the middle of the largest security crisis in Europe since the Second World War.
Plus the complicated history between Ukraine and Russia.
But that there was an independent Ukraine, it came about at the end or in the latter portion of World War I during the Russian Revolution.
And later in the program, what the crisis in Ukraine could mean for global food security. From the Voice of America, this is Flashpoint Ukraine. Good evening. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Ukrainian Foreign Minister Dmytro Kuleba appealed to the United Nations General Assembly on Wednesday to stop Russia's aggressive plans.
We are currently at the middle of the largest security crisis in Europe since the Second World War. This crisis was created and is being escalated by one side unilaterally, by the Russian Federation.
Kuleba's comments come as his country braced for further confrontation on Wednesday after Russian President Vladimir Putin received authorization to use military force outside his country. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres warned the 193-member body that an expanded conflict could see a scale and severity of need unseen for many years. The UNGA was meeting for its annual session about the annexation of Crimea in 2014 as Russia deploys more than 150,000 troops near Ukraine's borders and appears ready to invade. Russia has denied it wants to invade Ukraine and accuses Washington and allies of hysteria. In Ukraine, President Volodymyr Zelensky called up Army reservists and ordered military exercises for volunteers in the newly created Territorial Defense Brigades. But senior opposition lawmakers and former ministers fear the country is ill-prepared for war with Russia, despite their pleas for the government to get organized. Zelensky also proposed introducing a nationwide state of emergency earlier on Wednesday, as the country braces for a possible large-scale military offensive from Russia. Reuters news agency reports that in a draft of the measure, Ukraine could impose restrictions on the freedom of movement of conscripted reservists, impose curbs on the distribution of information and media, and introduce personal document checks. In Washington, U.S. President Joe Biden imposed sanctions on Nord Stream 2 AG and its corporate officers, saying the steps are another piece of the United States' initial tranche of sanctions in response to Russia's actions in Ukraine. On Tuesday, President Biden criticized the, quote, twisted rewrite of history that Russian President Vladimir Putin gave in his Monday evening address, in which he recognized two areas within Ukraine as sovereign states.
Nothing in Putin's lengthy remarks indicate any interest in pursuing real dialogue on European security in the year 2022. He directly attacked Ukraine's right to exist. He indirectly threatened territorial formerly held by Russia, including nations that today are thriving democracies and members of NATO. He explicitly threatened war unless his extreme demands were met.
Now, to get a better understanding of the complex history between Russia, Ukraine, as well as other states in the region, I spoke with Paul Post, a political science professor at the University of Chicago.
I mean, this is a longstanding view of his, right, that as many people who have long studied Putin himself have pointed out, is he has kind of this longing for the not just the Soviet Union, but Imperial Russia. And so you even saw references to that in his speech the other night, and kind of a lamenting that neither of these things exist anymore. And so this is kind of a worldview that he has, and Ukraine is front and center to that. There's the idea that Ukraine has always been properly part of Russia. It was part of the Russian Empire. It was part of the Soviet Union. And so, again, this is a long-held view by Putin. So it's not surprising that he would make these references. Having said that, of course, when he's talking about this, he is doing a little bit of rewriting of history, maybe even more than a little bit. A little bit is probably not the right way to say it. But that there was an independent Ukraine, it came about at the end or in the latter portion of World War One during the Russian Revolution, the same time that Finland became independent, 1917. And that is the part of Ukraine that is really the precursor, or that modern Ukraine is the successor state of, with that independent Ukraine that existed for a few years following the collapse of the Russian Empire and then before the establishment of the Soviet Union. And that was, Ukraine in many ways was very similar to, again, I mentioned Finland, but also the Baltic states. Now, the difference is that the Baltic states were able to maintain their independence at least for a couple decades until they were invaded again at the onset of World War II in Europe. That was, you know, oftentimes we talk about Germany invading Poland, but it's important to remember that it was Germany invading Poland at the same time that the Soviet Union invaded the Baltic states and Poland. And then they divided up those states.
So, Paul, putting the historical lens on current events, what does it all point to today?
Yeah, so what this points to is that Ukraine followed a similar path to a lot of other states that exist and existed it right after the collapse of Imperial Russia. The only difference is how long they were able to stay independent. And a lot, and you might say to yourself, well, why is it that Ukraine couldn't stay as independent as long as, say, the Baltic states or Finland specifically? And a big reason why is because Putin's worldview about Ukraine is one that is shared throughout a lot of the Russian elite, which is that Ukraine, at the end of the day, is really supposed to be part of Russia, has always been part of Russia, and should once again be part of Russia.
Geographically, culturally, you know, what is the larger relationship between the people who reside in modern-day Ukraine and those on the other side of the border in Russia?
So there's a great quote, and I'm trying to remember exactly who it came from, but it was a few years ago I read it, and it was during the time of the various color revolutions that were breaking out in the former Soviet republics. And he made this comment about Ukraine, and it very well captures exactly this point you're getting at, which is, he says, Eastern Ukraine is largely Russian, Western Ukraine is largely Polish, and then Kyiv is caught in the middle. And it really does kind of capture the dynamics of what you could see within that country, which is that there are a number of folks on the eastern part who identify ethnically as Russian. Of course, that's where these two provinces are that were declared independent. But as you go further west, you see less and less of that identification. You see more of an identification with Ukraine as a whole. Like, no, we're Ukrainian. We're not necessarily Russian.
So, Paul, history can be a powerful teacher. What lessons can be gleaned from the past?
So I think a lot can be learned by looking at the experience of the Baltic states. I think that the Baltic states point to, they really help inform why we're having this crisis. And I think this is a way to kind of answer your question. The reason why is, as I was talking about before, of course, the Baltic states became independent. Then they were reconquered by the Soviet Union, absorbed into the Soviet Union, and treated as republics of the Soviet Union. The key for thinking about the Baltics is that following the end of the Cold War and the collapse of the Soviet Union, the Baltic states immediately pursued a policy of wanting to join NATO. And they viewed it as essential for their security to eventually become part of NATO. And I think we can now witness why they were thinking that.
University of Chicago professor Paul Post. Despite his country's recent warming ties with Russia, Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has condemned Moscow's decision to recognize the two Ukrainian enclaves of Donetsk and Luhansk. Dorian Jones is up next.
Speaking to reporters, President Erdogan described as unacceptable Russia's recognition of the two breakaway regions in eastern Ukraine, calling on all parties to abide by international law. Turkey has strongly backed Ukraine, even selling Kiev its latest military drones, despite protests from Moscow. Last October, a Kremlin spokesman warned that Turkey's ongoing arms sales to Ukraine threatened to destabilize the region. Russia's increasingly aggressive policy in the shared Black Sea region is causing Ankara concern, says international relations professor Mustafa Aydın of Istanbul's Kadir Has University.
Until a few years ago, Turkey had the most powerful navy in the Black Sea after the end of the Cold War. But now Russia has surpassed. And especially militarization of the zone by Russia, not only Crimea, but across the Black Sea region, you know, from Armenia to the North Caucasus to Ukrainian border, it puts not only Turkey, but all the NATO countries also in a defensive position.
Erdogan has in recent years developed close relations with Russian President Vladimir Putin, extending from cooperating in Syria to trade and investment. Asla Aydin-Tashbash, a senior fellow at the European Council, says that relationship has put Moscow in a strong position with Ankara.
Russians hold way too many cards. They hold the card of refugees in Syria. One sortie from a Russian fighter jet could get people in Syria panic and run to the Turkish border. They hold the natural gas card. Turkey, in the middle of winter, does need Russian gas. And Russians have also been investing in Turkey's key infrastructures. They're building Turkey's first nuclear reactor.
Analysts point out that Turkey's dependency on Russian energy exports and cooperation in Syria mean Erdogan will have to tread carefully with Moscow. In addition, Russia sends Turkey's largest number of vacationers, boosting its key tourism sector, which provides vital foreign currency to the country's beleaguered economy. Analyst Atilla Yeşilada of Global Source Partners warns that with the Turkish economy struggling to recover from a currency collapse last year, Turkey is especially vulnerable to any retaliation from Russia.
If the currency weakens once more, obviously it will immediately pass through to inflation. Then inflation would shoot up towards hyperinflationary levels, which is unstable inflation, which may reach three digits.
Turkish presidential spokesman Ibrahim Kalın, in an interview with the German newspaper Die Welt last weekend, criticized sanctions on Russia, saying they were useless. Turkey strongly opposed earlier economic measures against Russia. As Ankara works to balance relations with both its Western allies and the Kremlin, analysts say the juggling act could face its greatest test in decades if the crisis over Ukraine deepens. Dorian Jones, VOA News, Istanbul.
You're listening to VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine. I'm Steve Miller. Ukraine is a significant player in global food security, but recent Russian aggression and naval deployment in the Black Sea threatens to disrupt Ukrainian grain exports, potentially affecting global supplies. Anna Rice narrates the story.
Ukraine produces over 6% of the world's grain supply, according to the Observatory of Economic Complexity. That's why there could be a ripple effect felt worldwide if war breaks out between Russia and Ukraine, says food analyst Alex Smith.
The countries that are the most dependent on Ukrainian wheat were Lebanon, which was about 50% of their total wheat consumption in 2020 came from Ukraine. Libya was a significant number, and so was Yemen. But all three of them have had significant conflicts recently, are already dealing with high food prices and already dealing with significant food insecurities.
If grain supply disruptions were to occur now, it would shock world markets, say experts.
For Ukraine, they have a lot of sales on the books to countries like China and other major importers. If that were to be disrupted, it causes a significant dislocation in the flow.
And with an ongoing drought in South America, the world depends even more on other sources, like Ukrainian wheat.
As it happens, the other major producers are South America, Brazil, and Argentina. They are going through a drought situation. So these next couple months in front of us is already in a tight corn and wheat supply situation. And if you cut off imports or disrupt those that flow of grain from a major region, that would have huge impacts. It would send prices sharply higher.
Food analyst Smith believes a disruption in the supply of Ukrainian grain might benefit Russia, since countries like China might turn to Russia to get grain. Russian President Vladimir Putin and China's President Xi Jinping recently signed an agreement in which China agreed to allow imports of wheat and barley from all regions of Russia.
I think there's potential that Russia is a significant wheat producer as well. I mean, just agriculturally is a large, you know, exporter in general. I think that they definitely have capacity to fill in some of this scarcity that could come from a Russia-Ukraine conflict.
Analysts hope a disruption in grain supplies can be avoided. Otherwise, a food crisis could be a real possibility, not only in the region, but far beyond. For Oksana Bedratenko in Washington, Anna Rice, VOA News.
While the ongoing situation in Ukraine is the world focus, Russia has been rebuilding ties with Africa more quietly, strengthening economic and military cooperation on the continent. That is raising concerns among Western nations about its tactics and goals there. VOA's Carol Gunsberg takes it from here.
Russian flags waved in Burkina Faso's capital following January's military coup in the West African nation. A statue unveiled in the Central African Republic last fall shows local soldiers backed by Russian fighters protecting civilians. Those are the more obvious symbols of Russia's resurgent presence on the continent. In 2019, at the first Russian Africa summit of political and business leaders, Russian President Vladimir Putin made it clear Africa is a Russian priority.
It was agreed at the summit to create a new mechanism for dialogue in the form of a Russia-Africa partnership.
A second summit is planned for St. Petersburg in October. The first, in Sochi, generated diplomatic agreements and billions of dollars worth of deals for arms, agriculture, energy, and more, said organizer Roscongress Foundation. Moscow's overtures in recent years offer cooperation without what Putin has called the political or other considerations imposed by Western countries.
Russia provides, as did the Soviet Union before, an alternative vision for African nations. If there is one common feature between what the Russians are doing now and what the Soviets used to do, it's this common anti-Western critique.
The spread of militant Islamist extremism and other violence in Africa has created more openings for Russia's military. In Mali, so has the planned drawdown of troops by France, Mali's former colonial ruler and partner in the fight against jihadists for nearly a decade. Private military contractors also are helping advance Moscow's agendas in Africa, Western observers say. These include fighters in the shadowy Wagner Group, allegedly controlled by Putin associate Yevgeny Prigozhin. Putin has denied any connection with the group.
It is not the state. It is private business with private interests tied to extracting energy resources, including various resources like gold or precious stones.
But experts say whatever the goal, the result is that where the Wagner Group shows up, trouble follows.
Every place we've seen Wagner deployed around the world and in Africa, be it in Libya, Sudan, Mozambique, Central African Republic, it has been a destabilizing force.
Joseph Siegel, with the Africa Center for Strategic Studies, says mercenaries are part of Moscow's toolkit to prop up weak African leaders in exchange for economic or other advantages. They aid elites, not average citizens.
What Russia has been doing deploying mercenaries, disinformation, election interference, arms for resources, deals, opaque contracts.
The United Nations is investigating reports of grave human rights abuses in the Central African Republic, allegedly committed by private military personnel. In Mali, the leaders of a 2020 military coup have brought in Russian military trainers and what U.S. and French authorities say are Wagner mercenaries. Some in Mali welcomed them by waving Russian flags, reflecting not only the country's historic ties with the former USSR, but also public impatience over continued insecurity.
In 2013, the Malian population were enthusiastic when the French arrived in the countries. And you can see today that they are rejecting their presence. To be honest, I would not be very surprised if in 2 years or so, the same could happen with the Russian presence, in fact.
Niagale Bagayoko, who chairs the African Security Sector Network, says African countries are showing a willingness to look beyond a single foreign partner.
There is the realization of the fact that being only engaged with a single actors or with a single group of countries is restricting the possibilities for diplomacy, but also for military apparatus.
Russia isn't the only foreign government trying to broaden influence in Africa, home to vast resources and a surging young population. The White House plans a second U.S.-Africa summit later this year, and the European Union has announced a new $170 million investment in infrastructure to counter China's Belt and Road Initiative. China has been Africa's biggest economic partner for at least a decade. Carol Gunsberg, VOA News, Washington.
The psychosocial well-being of an entire generation of Ukrainian children is at risk from war in the country's eastern Donbas region. That's according to the United Nations Children's Fund. With legions of Russian troops now pouring in, the situation is only worse. VOA's Veronica Balderas Iglesias rounds us out.
From her house in Kyiv, Anna Voits closely monitors the situation in Ukraine's Luhansk region, which on Monday was recognized by Russian President Vladimir Putin as, quote, independent state, unquote, and where Voits' relatives live in the shadow of war.
My six-year-old niece does not go to school and her dance class because of the shelling around the city.
Voits, her husband, and their three sons fled the region 8 years ago after Russia annexed Crimea and instigated a separatist war in eastern Ukraine. It was hard on the children.
We could not even rent an apartment because we, as internally displaced persons, were denied housing. They also refused us housing because they saw that we have three children. The children saw our emotional struggle.
But for families that can't flee, the trauma persists and is worsening now as more Russian troops officially move in. After artillery shells hit a kindergarten in the eastern territories on February 17, UNICEF warned, quote, the conflict has taken a severe toll on the psychosocial well-being of an entire generation of children, unquote. Local child advocates say the trauma is evident in many ways. SOS Children's Village's national director in Ukraine, Serhiy Lukashov.
It is becoming the part of their personality through the passive aggression, through the difficulties for younger children, difficulties in communication.
Julius Kubietsa is the project director at the War Childhood Museum in Ukraine.
It's not just about psychological effect. It's about chronic diseases that develop because of the stress, because of the lack of access to basic, to fulfilling the basic needs, because of the loss of safety.
An advisor to the United Nations on displaced people, Professor Elizabeth Ferris, says she's terrified there will be a full-scale Russian invasion.
UNICEF right now estimates that some 400,000 children are in need of humanitarian assistance before any more conflict erupts. The immediate needs will be to provide shelter, and this is the middle of winter, to people who are displaced, to provide probably medical care would be urgent, water, food, shelter.
Anna Voits knows the struggle her own niece faces if forced to leave.
It will be a scar for life because you lived in your house, in your native environment, with your friends and family. Then your life changes radically.
In June 2020, Ukraine told the United Nations that 147 children had died during the Russian armed aggression in Donbas, many by shelling, mines, or touching explosives. For the sake of her niece and others, Voits can only hope for the war to end. Veronica Valderas Iglesias for VOA News, Washington.
And that'll do it for us today. You know, the news doesn't stop when this show ends, so be sure to point your web browser to voanews.com for continuing coverage on Ukraine and other news from around the world. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have a great night.